Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is the anniversary, the 20th anniversary of 9/11. We will talk about that today. Of course, this is also the day after Joe Biden dropped what I called in my newsletter, the mother of all mandates. Actually, it's kind of a quasi mandate. Not everybody thinks it goes far enough. Other people are absolutely hysterical about it. So we'll talk about all of that. And we are joined by our good friend, Tom Nichols, who's probably just as annoyed as I am this morning. So I'm just guessing.
Although it's hard to tell when I'm more annoyed than any other day, but yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I have to, before we get involved in this, I keep thinking about the 20 year anniversary of something, and I have to admit I'm kind of obsessed with time and the relative nature of time. You know, that 20 years is so long, and yet it feels so immediate, and everybody's doing their memories. But I had an odd experience last night. Can I tell you about it? Just mention
it. Yes, please.
It? Okay. So my wife and I are out for dinner. We do that very, very rarely, but it's an outside, really nice outdoor restaurant in Wisconsin. And those of us who live in Wisconsin, where we have about 6 minutes of summer, always take advantage of that. And our waitress was, I think, maximum 21 years old, maybe younger than that, very young girl. And there's music playing in the background, and I'm watching her come out of the restaurant to where we were, and she is singing along sort of under her breath, all of, lip syncing, all of the lyrics from White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane.
Okay. Oh dear.
And I could tell she had every one of them. She knew all the words. And what struck me was White Rabbit was released in 1967. Okay. 1967, because math is not required on this podcast, 1967 was 54 years ago, and kids are still singing it. Do you know what 54 years before 1967 was? Yes, you do. It's 1913. We are as separated from 1967 as 1967 was from 1913, which blows my mind, because I just doubt that young kids in 1967 were singing the greatest hits of 1913. Do you know what I mean?
First, thank you for starting this podcast by sucking my will to live right out of my 60-year-old body, Charlie. Holy crap.
Isn't that something I just...
Yes, but it also shows you that rock and roll became the dominant music form in the world. It was not a flash in the pan. My father, God rest his soul, used to say rock and roll is crap.
Yeah.
It is the dominant form of music, and it has its classics. But I will also tell you, just to make us both feel older, I was listening to the Sinatra station on my satellite radio and saying, on the other hand, talking 56, 57 years ago, I can still sing along with every word of The Lady is a Tramp. There are just classics. So, it's okay,
weird. What year was that released?
Well, I think the live version that I like, where he does the whole, hey, knock down cuckoo crazy, nutty broad in Harlem thing. I think that was 1965. I think that was one of his kind of live capital releases. And you can hear him walking around with doing things you can't do, right? Walking around with a cigarette, spilling drinks on people, and calling dames and broads cuckoo and knocked out, and it's just. But I get that. I mean, 20 years before 9/11. I mean, if you really want to play that game, 20 years before 9/11, Ronald Reagan was being inaugurated, and suddenly you say, wow, that seems like a really long time ago. Although I have to say 20 years ago for 9/11 seems a long time ago to me now.
It does. It is an entire lifetime. And by the way, relying on Google, which is the source of all things, right? The Lady is a Tramp was in the album A Swinging Affair, which came out in 1957.
Yeah,
which
was the studio version.
64.
Well, the studio version was earlier, but there's a version that he popularized later, came out in the early 60s, where, again, he doesn't sing. He kind of walks around slapping people upside the head while he's singing. And it's totally Frank, baby. And that's the version I always listen to.
Okay, so if it's 1957, though, that's 64 years ago.
Yeah, before I was born.
So do the math. We're now into the 19th century. If, you know, 64 years before 1957. The reason I mention this is we talk about historical eras, and there's always a hangover. I mean, the fact is that what's happening now, you know, is shadowed and clouded by what happened in the 1960s. None of us are complete contemporaries. Do you know what I mean? You know, we grew up in a world that was I grew up in a world that was shaped by the 1940s and the 1950s. And this means a lot of things that are happening now are going to shadow and shape things that are going to happen 40 or 50 years from now. And we can't possibly even predict what that's going to be. Although, as you point out, there are decades that just have a longer lifespan. I mean, it's, you know, the music of 1913 just has not dominated the century.
I was going to ask.
You know, in a way the 1960s has, right?
What was the top hit of 1913? Happy Birthday? You know, what? Yeah, I can't even imagine that.
Top hits songs of, okay, all right. When Irish Eyes Are Smiling. When Irish Eyes Are Smiling.
But we still sing that one now and then, once a year anyway.
Peg of My Heart. Let's see. The Spaniard Who Blighted My Life by Al Jolson. There was no young waitress in 1967 that was whistling The Spaniard Who Blinded My Life.
Right. She couldn't wait to get off her shift after The Summer of Love and run back to her apartment and crank up a 78 RPM of Al Jolson.
Okay, Tom, should we segue right to Angry Dad? Dad yesterday, who wanted to turn the car around.
I do have one thing to say about history and the anniversary of 9/11. Always remember, especially when you're judging people in other historical periods, and think about the one you'll be judged in. Mm-hmm. My favorite saying to my students is David McCullough, the historian, who said, remember, people living back then didn't know they were living back then. They were living in their now. And as you said, every period creates its historical hangover. And whatever's happening now, you know, 20 years from now, people are going to say, wow, these two guys, Charlie and Tommy, are talking about this stuff. It seems so. Well, that's because we don't know that we're living back then. This is now.
This is funny. I was doing one of the cable hits, and they were talking about, you know, Roe versus Wade and the challenge in the courts. And so I was sitting there waiting to go on. They were playing the night of January 22nd of 1973, the NBC report about that court decision. And you're watching this black and white news broadcast of this. And I'm going, holy crap, that was a long time ago. It was like a different world, different universe. But back in 1973, I was a freshman in college, and I didn't know I was way back there. I thought things were pretty contemporary. And it was sort of a surprise that you know, what I had thought was the modern world was, in fact, no, that was really a long time ago, old guys. Old guy covers there. Okay, speaking of old guys, we talk about the Angry Dad.
Yes.
Okay. Angry Dad came out.
And we all know who that is.
Angry Dad. Let's play Angry Dad from yesterday.
This is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. And it's caused by the fact that despite America having unprecedented and successful vaccination program, despite the fact that for almost 5 months, free vaccines have been available in 80,000 different locations, we still have nearly 80 million Americans who have failed to get the shot. And to make matters worse, there are elected officials actively working to undermine the fight against COVID-19. Instead of encouraging people to get vaccinated and mask up, they're ordering mobile morgues for the unvaccinated dying from COVID in their communities. This is totally unacceptable. Third, if you wonder how all this adds up, here's the math. The vast majority of Americans are doing the right thing. Nearly three quarters of the eligible have gotten at least one shot. But one quarter has not gotten any. That's nearly 80 million Americans not vaccinated. And a country as large as ours, that's 25% minority. That 25% can cause a lot of damage, and they are. The unvaccinated overcrowd our hospitals, are overrunning emergency rooms and intensive care units, leaving no room for someone with a heart attack or pancreatitis or cancer.
So then he drops the mandates, which includes the requirement. Apparently, they're going to issue an OSHA requirement of all companies over 100 employees to either make sure that their employees are either vaccinated or tested every week. Mandate of for vaccinations of 17 million healthcare workers who work for facilities that get Medicare and Medicaid. Which I think is kind of a no-brainer, and a sweeping mandate for all federal employees. And, of course, the reaction was completely predictable. Republicans are absolutely all in against this. They're filing lawsuits against this. They're pushing back against this. They're salivating at the idea of mass protests against this. And then you had people like Josh Mandel, who is the leading Republican candidate for United States Senator in the state of Ohio. There's a reasonable chance that he will be a member of the United States Senate in a year and a half. This is what Josh meant. He posted a short video urging people to resist this. Let's play Josh Mandel.
And I'm hoping and praying that the Supreme Court justices that he appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court will do the right thing and stand up for the Constitution, stand up for our freedom, stand up for our liberty. And if they don't, I call on my fellow Americans, do not comply. Do not comply with the tyranny. And when the Gestapo show up at your front door, you know what to do.
Well, Tom Nichols, what does that mean? I don't recall that the Gestapo went door to door requiring people to get vaccinated, but I don't know. You know more about history than I do.
It means... That's Josh Mandel being unbelievably thirsty and saying, I will say anything to be a U.S. senator. That's what it all comes down to. That's that he and J.D. Vance are in the, you know, thirstiest young man in Ohio competition. And the prize is a U.S. Senate seat. And
but this is now the norm. This is the norm of Republicans. Right. If you're running in a Republican primary, you have to use this kind of rhetoric that requiring, you know, or well, mandating or encouraging more vaccinations. These mandates, this is the Gestapo. This is tyranny. This is authoritarianism or something.
Well, it's all the entire Republican Party now is built on grievance and paranoia and victimhood and, you know, just stoking huge amounts of rage-a-hall. And making sure people just, you know, mainline that that kind of fury right into their veins every day and without even understanding it. And the sickest thing about it, the really most appalling and disgusting thing about all this is that Mandel and Vance and all the rest of these guys that are running in the GOP, they know what they're doing. I mean, we can always cut that exception for, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's just nuts, right? You know, or Louis Gohmert, who's just stupid. But when you get to somebody like Mandel or Vance, they know exactly what they're doing. They know exactly which buttons they're pushing. These are, you know, and I hope people listening who have any inclination of sympathy for these guys understand that they say this stuff and then they get on the elevator, you know, or close the door to their office and they burst out laughing. You know, they know, they sit there and they poll test this, they craft this message. Mandel doesn't care that he's calling for actual violence. I mean, the Gestapo coming to your door, you know what to do. That's never going to be a problem for Josh Mandel, but that'll be a problem, you know, for some poor census taker or something who you know, gets a shotgun blast through a door because guys like Mandel, you know, have spun people up to think that anybody who knocks on your door is, you know, is Himmler.
Well, and also,
I mean, it's crazy.
It's sort of the deniability of it. So Josh, what are you talking about? When the Gestapo shows
I'm just
up at your
asking
door,
questions.
You know what to do. What is that, right, Josh? What are you telling people to do? To say, hey, excuse me, not today. We're not buying. You know, close the door. I'm sorry, we're having dinner or I'm washing my hair, and then politely close the door or fire the shotgun blast. What is it, Josh? What are you actually saying? So, and I want to get into the pros and cons of what Biden's doing, because I think that there are legitimate legal questions about the legal authority. This is going to be challenged in court, and I I think people ought to expect that there are going to be legal challenges and that portions of this might be thrown out. But, you know, to your point about this is kind of the norm of the Republican Party, it's true, but there are exceptions. And I do think it's kind of interesting to watch the split between governors like, for example, the Republican governor of West Virginia, Jim Justice, and Ron DeSantis down in Florida. Ron DeSantis, who's going into a complete performative assholery and, you know, cynical demagoguery, selling T-shirts, "Don't Fauci my Florida." Meanwhile, Jim Justice, who represents one of the Trumpiest states in the country, is just not having it. Let's play a little bit of him, because he's been all over the place telling people, would you just get the freaking vaccine?
For God's sakes, a living. How difficult is this to understand? Why in the world do we have to come up with these crazy ideas? And they're crazy ideas that the vaccine's got something in it. And it's tracing people wherever they go. And the same very people that are saying that are carrying their cell phones around. I mean, come on.
Hey, but you know.
See, he's doing what you're saying. He's not like sucking up to them. He's like,
no,
people are crazy. This is stupid. This is nuts. I am done. I'm out of patience. So what Justice is doing is he's demonstrating, you know, you don't have to go along with the crazy. You can push back, right?
He's doing the right thing.
Amazing.
But, you know, look, I'm not, you know, I said on Twitter when this first happened, I may not be a big Jim Justice fan in a lot of other ways, but what a relief. God bless him, you know, to hear a man just come out and say, listen, cut the crazy stuff. But on the other hand, you know, the one place if you're going to push Governor Justice just a little harder to say, hey, the people in your state needed to hear that. Now call up all the people in your party and tell them to cut the crap. Because they're the ones that are making it impossible to continue this and to get it done, because you're not just up against people, you know, in West Virginia who are hesitant or believing crazy stuff. You're up against all of Fox News, all of your other Republican governors, you know.
See, Tom, but you know how that phone call goes. This goes back to your point before. You know, it's, you know, Justice calls up whoever it's going to be. Hey, you know, Tucker, or hey, Sean, or whoever you're talking to. You know, we got to cut this crap. We have to, I mean, you know, Lord Almighty, whatever. By the way, this would have been, you know, in place in 1937. But, you know, we got to start telling people the right thing. And what they would say is, oh, of course, Jim, I know that, you know that, but the rubes don't want it. They won't take it. We can't say those things, because then we'll get all the blowback and we'll get roasted on Facebook. Because this is the thing, Tom, it's a huge scam. And I think this is a point that people have to make, that the folks out there who have been convinced that they're victims, you know, have convinced that the establishment and the elites really look down on them. They need to understand that they are being scammed by their own elites, who are right, themselves vaccinated, who would never be around people who are not vaccinated, but are smirking to themselves, but then are loading, you know, unloading the bullshit to the unwashed masses. And at some point you realize, wait, you're telling me I don't need to be vaxxed, but all you folks at Fox News, you've all been vaxxed, right? You've been vaxxed. Right. Josh Mandela's been vaxxed. J.D. Vance has been vaxxed. And yet you're scamming me. You're giving me this load of, you're trying to sell me the snake oil. And I kind of, you know, maybe they're immune to that, but at some point they ought to realize what the deal is.
I don't know how many different ways you can tell people, and I've tried, you know, in person to say, no one looks down on you more than the evening lineup of Fox News and the Republican Party.
Right.
No one thinks less of you than Tucker Carlson. No one laughs at you behind your back more often than Josh Mandel or Donald Trump or J.D. Vance or any of these other people. These are educated, ambitious people. Well, not in Trump's case. I mean, Trump doesn't have a I've always thought Trump doesn't have a fully realized personality that he's capable of this kind of, you know, cleverness. But, you know, the rest of them, Kevin McCarthy, you know, they know what they're doing and they're looking down on you. And, you know, it's people always get on my case about it. I say, well, you can't talk down to these people. I'm not talking down to anybody. I am talking to them like peers and trying to hold them responsible and giving them static in the same way that I would give a friend static. And instead of saying, you know what, I understand, you're too stupid, you're too dumb to understand, you're too victimized, I'm talking to these people like they're members. These people are fellow citizens, like they are members of my own family. The people that are talking to you like you're morons, like you're toddlers, are the entire primetime, you know, Jeanine Pirro knows exactly what she's doing and, you know, gets on there and just talks down to you and spins you up and then, you know, chuckles to herself walking off camera and saying, you know, another day, another dollar.
Well, okay. So whether they're laughing or not, I mean, people need to understand how important this point is because, you know, J.D. Vance is a Yale law grad, all of this stuff. These are smart. You know, Tucker Carlson is a smart, literate guy. So when they put stuff out that is written or spoken at the sixth grade level, when they go for the dumbest possible meme, that is the definition of condescension. Who do they think their constituency is? And they always go for the lowest common denominator. So right. Whether they think it's funny or not, that's what they're doing. They are talking down. And so this whole thing, well, Josh Mandel does this because he's feeding the red meat to the base. Okay, well, let's think about what that means. He thinks that this is the kind of bigoted gruel that his voters really crave, that this will work for him. And he's not totally wrong. But it is this underlying contempt for the folks out there. Because if you actually respect your constituents, you will speak to them. You will tell them, I'm sorry, you're wrong about this. I'm going to talk to you like an adult. I'm going to use language that at least a ninth grader would understand, as opposed to, you know, simply assuming that you want some sort of dumbed down internet meme / bumper sticker. By the way, remember people talk about bumper sticker slogans? Bumper sticker slogans were Aristotle compared to what these guys are putting out right now.
Yeah. And they never think to their instinct is never to say, look, I'm here to elevate you and educate you and help you understand as a broadcaster. I am here to, you know, help you navigate a complicated world. Instead, it's I'm going to simplify everything to a jolt of cortisol that's going to marinate your heart in anger chemicals for the next hour, because that's going to keep your eyeballs on me. And that's how I'm going to make my money. You know, David Frum said it best about Tucker Carlson. Tucker likes money and he likes being on TV. And so, if that means saying things that are literally at the kind of, you know, bumper sticker level of immigrant caravans and Fauci is a fraud and, you know, stuff that Tucker Carlson, who, as you keep pointing out, I don't think it can be repeated too often, who works in a hermetically, carefully controlled, vaccinated, anti-COVID environment while telling other people to go out there and take their chances on losing their lives. You know, if that's what they have to do, then that's what we're going to do. That's what they're going to do. And it's hideous. There's a hideousness to it that I think, and by the way, just to emphasize your point, Charlie, and when Tucker went to court and said, no reasonable person could believe what I'm saying is real.
Yeah, he did. So let's talk about the Joe Biden, you know, Joe Biden's proposals, his mandates. I see that Lena Wynn, the doctor, I think she was the former president of Planned Parenthood, has a piece in the Washington Post where she describes them as tepid half measures, which I think is interesting because these are, I think, objectively speaking, you know, rather dramatic, an indication that the Biden administration sees the spreading pandemic as a threat to, well, obviously, you know, human life, also to the economy, also to the Biden presidency. I do think that there are some questions about whether, you know, the ability of the administrative state to tell businesses that what they have to do. On the other hand, let's be honest about this, and this is going to make its way through the courts. And I think there are legitimate arguments that are going to be made about the statutory authority. I think the constitutional issue has been was settled back in 1905, by the way, rather clearly. But in the short term, I think this will save lives. I think this this will change behavior, and all this rhetoric, well, people are going to resist, or, you know, opposition will harden. Okay, this may not change hearts and minds, may not persuade anybody, you know, may fuel the outrage machines, but there will be people, there will be hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, who will get the vaccination as a result of this, who would not otherwise have done so, and human lives will be saved. This is an emergency.
Yeah, there's two things that to think about, or three things to think about with the Biden mandates. First, I think Dr. Nguyen has always been, I'm not going to argue with her as a doctor, but as a policy analyst, I'm going to say there's a lot of her reactions to this over the past weeks has been way beyond, I think, what, you know, policy can do. I mean, she was talking about, you know, all vaccinations for all transportation and a national registry and an ID. I mean, you know, I'm pretty hardcore about vaccination, and I don't think that's required. So I think she's kind of over the top on some of those policy recommendations. Second is that, good conservatives who care about limited government, some of this is going to make us itch. I don't want to be at a place where the president, out of exasperation, has to step in where states and Congress and everyone else has simply failed and say, okay, well, I'll give it a shot and I'll mandate it and we'll see what happens in the courts. That's not an effective democracy. I understand why Biden did it. I understand that people are going to, if he doesn't do it, people are going to die. My point about executive overreach is shame on us that it ever had to get this far. And the third thing I'd say about it is, I think people are underestimating how mandates, and I've been making this point now for a few days, mandates might finally let people off the hook in communities where there is peer pressure not to get vaccinated. And I was thinking of this because of a CNN segment where a reporter visited a town in the Ozarks, and was clear. Did you see? Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was a doctor saying, oh yeah, I've been vaccinating people secretly. Like people, you know, imagine how insane America has become that you have to give somebody a life-saving vaccination secretly so that their neighbors won't judge them about a simple 15-minute no-brainer in a country where we are vaccinated for 100 things before we even go to school. And so I think there may be, you know, the mandate may be the moment where people can turn to their neighbors with, silent relief and say, well, you know, I would never have gotten it. But, you know, what are you going to do?
I guess I just
have to get it.
I think this is a real thing. And I've heard those anecdotes as well. In fact, just this last weekend, I heard about a nanny who, was taking care of a family's children, and members of the family would come up to her and sort of whisper, hey, by the way, I did get vaccinated, but please don't tell anybody else in the family, you know, just to, because, you know, I don't want to have to deal with their pushback. So this does give people permission to do all of that. I also think, I don't know what the politics of this are going to be. The Republicans are salivating. They're calling for mass protest. I think that most people are just fed up. I think that particularly among the people who have given up, made massive sacrifices over the last year and a half, whose lives have been disrupted, whose jobs have been disrupted, who haven't seen family members. And this is all being endangered by people who will not do something as basic as, I don't know, just, you know, the kind of hygiene that we take for granted. I mean, the reason that we don't see people with polio around is because we understood that the vaccines will give us freedom from disease. And I know this may sound a little bit paradoxical, but, you know, yes, this mandate, you know, does infringe on individual choice in some cases. But the reality is that it will give us the freedom to go on with our lives. It is the right to life. It is the freedom to get back to our daily routines, to see our family, to see our friends, to be able to travel, to go back to school. None of those things will be possible if we continue to indulge the people who are unvaccinated and refuse to be vaccinated.
And I'm like, take
the fucking vaccine, as McSweeney's wrote the other day.
Oh, that McSweeney's piece. Can't recommend that enough. I mean, you know, holy shit, was that funny. But it's not, and it's people who are doing it. as attention-seeking behavior. This isn't even people who are coming forward and saying, look, I'm really anguished about this. I'm scared. I don't know if the vaccine really works. It could make me sick. I mean, they're kind of saying that. But then, you know, like the guy we were watching on CNN, he said, you know why I'm not taking it? Because I'm stubborn, and that's who I am. Well, then screw you, man. Yeah. You know, I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm a stubborn jackass is not a reason to endanger the people around you. And I think, you know, imagine, like you mentioned polio. We didn't have a mandate for polio. People say, well, we didn't have a mandate for polio. Yes, because we didn't need one.
Right.
Because people were lining up to get the damn vaccine. Can you imagine, Charlie, do you remember when we were young? I think it was the TB vaccine that left the round scar on your arm.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And that's how you knew that you'd been vaccinated. And everybody, my mom had one of those, you know, my dad had one on his arm, you know. Today you'd be hearing people say, mark of the devil. We've been scarred. It's a scar. We've been branded by, you know, big medicine, yada, yada, yada. Of course, you know, tuberculosis, it still exists, but functionally eradicated for just about all of the healthy people. Not only did you take a vaccine, it left a scar on your arm and it immediately identified you as, you know, at the beach, you could turn and say, oh yeah, that's your TB scar. People today would lose their fucking minds about this as if it's a plot. And I'm going to hammer something, you know, I'm not going to do a big book ad, but hammer something I've been writing about, which is narcissism. You know, it's like Fauci is out to stick microchips in me because I'm that important. And I love Jim Justice saying, you think the government's going to go to all this effort to track you when you're carrying your phone around with you all day, which is just hilarious. And, you know, again, God bless Jim. I've never thought I'd say this. God bless Jim Justice. That made me laugh out loud. And he was absolutely right.
Okay, so before we move on from this, people ought to look up, just at least keep in the back of your mind, the Supreme Court case, Jacobson versus Massachusetts, the opinion written by Justice John Marshall Harlan, who was a giant in terms of civil liberties. His dissents, his opinions, you know, show that this was somebody who had thought very, very deeply about individual rights, about the Constitution. He's certainly not an outlier. And back in 1905, Supreme Court ruled in that case 7-2 that vaccine mandates were constitutional. And here's the key sentence. Real liberty for all could not exist under the operation of a principle which recognizes the right of each individual person to use his own liberty, whether in respect of his person or his property, regardless of the injury that may be done to others. This is something that we used to understand, right? That real liberty didn't mean that anybody could do anything they wanted, even if it hurt the community, even if it hurt or killed other people. That's not real liberty. That's anarchy. That's weaponized narcissism. And right. To watch, you know, the anti-vax people, including the anti-vax pro-lifers, you know, say, my body, myself, you know, I mean, I'm going to say my body, my choice. It's so cynical. And
The same people on the right who are screaming about resisting tyranny with a vaccine mandate are applauding a Texas law that turns ordinary citizens into East German informers on each other. You know, there is no consistency. There is no intellectual consistency. Everything is about owning the libs, saying no, throwing temper tantrums, holding your breath till you're blue, and always choosing the policy where you think people you don't like haven't already been as a policy. So you just look and you say, who are the people in the world I hate? What do they believe in? Whatever's the opposite of that. I mean, we literally could start walking down the street and saying, you know, be nice to your mom, you know, adopt a shelter puppy. And these guys would say, don't you tell me whether or not I can, you know, slap my mom and whether or not I can beat up a shelter puppy. I mean, that's who they are now. This toddler-like, contrarian, nihilistic movement that is completely incapable of any kind of intellectual or moral consistency to say, you know, we can't have the government making these big mandates, but if the government wants to deputize individuals as bounty hunters to inform on each other, to bankrupt each other in court, that would be awesome.
Okay, so you saw that I got into a very small Twitter back and forth with a very, very outspoken anti-abortion, pro-life commentator, Alexandra De Sanctis. And I just tweeted, I thought the irony of language, because I'm always interested in how language is used as political weaponry. I texted about 2 hours ago for our taping. Interesting hearing my body, my choice, and the right to choose from right-wing anti-vax pro-lifers, # cognitive dissonance. And she wrote back, the whole crux of the argument against abortion is that there is, quote, another human body, unquote, involved. I know that you know this. I've been making this argument long before she was even born. I said, yes, and a pandemic that's killed more than 600,000 people also involves, wait for it, other human beings. And this is where you have the block, which is that your behavior puts other people at risk and people are dying as a result of it. So you would think that the very people who say that, well, I am pro-life because, you know, it involves another human being. Well, we are talking about, yes, other human beings in the real world who right now are on ventilators.
Right. And who are defenseless. You know, this, all of the arguments that folks like her would make, right? You're talking about defenseless human beings who have no choice in the matter, you know, who are at the mercy of another. Well, that would be, you know, old people that you run into in a store, people children. In a classroom, children. But it shows you how much of this is about seizing the high ground or the perceived high ground in the political struggle rather than maintaining some kind of consistent principle that, you know, you defend the innocent, you look out for other human beings, you think about the risk to innocent lives, that all of that goes away when it's not the particular issue that they want to talk about, because that, you know, that's what they generate their political capital out of. And I think it's just sad in a way. But, you know, and again, I thought the part of, you know, I know you know this. And I'm like, yeah, Charlie knew this.
You were a zygote.
Exactly. So, you know.
All right. Let's take a deep breath here and talk about the crazy, but also the speech that Chris Christie gave last night. Okay, so I need to take a little bit of a deep breath. Let's talk about this in just a moment. Hey, Charlie Sykes here. Just a quick reminder, if you sign up for Bulwark Plus, you will have access to our morning newsletters, to JVL's Triad, as well as our whole suite of podcasts. This one will remain free, but if you want to listen to The Secret Podcast or participate in our live streams or others like The Next Level Podcast, please consider joining Bulwark Plus. Okay, we're back with Tom Nichols. We've been talking about the vaccine mandates, the mother of all mandates, the blowback that we're getting. Oh, by the way, I'm sure that you saw that the TSA is now cracking down. I know you're concerned about airplane etiquette. The TSA has decided they are really cracking down on passengers who won't wear masks. So it is interesting, by the way, that post 9/11, all the things that this country was willing to do and how we pulled together, and it was a patriotic duty to make various sacrifices and have some national purpose. The Republican Party was all in on that. And think about how different the Republican Party is today about pulling together to confront a national crisis.
You know, I was watching a guy lose his shit on an airplane recently. And I thought, and I actually said, if we'd have lasted 15 minutes in World War II with a population like this, it just would have been over. The idea that you should be inconvenienced in any way, has, for the sake of any kind of larger public good, has completely gone out the window. And we think nothing of completely losing our minds in public and throwing tantrums and threatening each other and, you know, assaulting each other, because we've regressed. It's like we're a nation of three-year-olds. We're like a nation of three-year-olds with car keys and guns and whiskey. It's tragic. I mean, it's not how America became the country that it is, that it became a, you know, a superpower, it became, you know, an immensely wealthy country with all of our problems, with all of our flaws, with all of our drawbacks, we were always able to cooperate and do great things together. And we're not capable of doing even mildly challenging things together anymore. And you're seeing this now devolve to the states where, you know, instead of, when we talk about national vaccination rates, what we're really talking about is averaging out Vermont and Alabama.
Yeah.
You know, which is really not the way, you know, we should have been able to do this as a country. And I think the TSA issue is really important because people, you know, for all my joking around about, you know, people acting like slobs and pigs on airplanes, you don't have a right to fly on an airplane.
Right.
You know, this is not like, you know, the neighborhood carpool. Flying on an airplane is a contract with a private, you know, with a private carrier that's agreeing to take you somewhere. And the idea that you can just lose your shit and just go off on everybody. Yeah, I'm really glad that the TSA is cracking down on this. And I was really glad to see, you know, that stores. I mean, there was a viral video the other day, some woman, I guess, who just got fired for losing her mind in a store, walking up and coughing on people. And, you know, stores are throwing people out for that. You know, it used to be a year ago, we'd see them saying, please, you know, understand it's our policy. Now they're just like, okay, out.
We're done with you.
It's over. Right.
Well, I'm thinking back when the TSA first came in after 9/11, you know, the inconvenience was considerable. The humiliations were considerable. In fact, I just flew to DC last week and I had a little thing of shaving cream in my bag that I'd forgotten I'd put there, and it was confiscated from me, and I could have pitched a fit, right? Except I realized, no, this is the way it is.
Right.
The world is not safer because I don't have my shaving cream. You know, I'm going to be a little bit scruffier, you know, et cetera. But what I recall is that I don't recall people pitching fits when they were asked to take off their shoes and their belts and screaming and everything. I do remember some pushback. I think it was the Ron Paul types who talked about, you know, some of the excesses of TSA agents, but they were such a small minority. It wasn't this massive cultural push, because I think people understood there's a rational connection between we have a real threat of terrorism out there. There are real, you know, security concerns. And I'm going to have to go along with all of this. You know, do you see Will Salatin's piece in Slate where he talked about why the party of 9/11 couldn't handle COVID-19? And he, you know, goes back to talk about, you know, what happened under the Bush administration and the sacrifices people were asked to make. And he says today, in the face of a far more deadly enemy, Republicans have done the opposite. They belittled the pandemic. They've scorned vigilance. They've defended reckless individualism. They've obstructed efforts to protect the public. And his bottom line is, explaining the contrast, the simple truth is the Republicans don't know how to deal with this kind of enemy. It doesn't speak Arabic, Farsi, or Chinese. It doesn't invoke or Spanish. It doesn't invoke
or
the
Russian.
Name of, yeah. Or of Allah. Politicians can't rile up crowds or raise money by uniting Americans against it, as they did really against radical Islamic terrorism. And so this really has been a test of character. It challenged Republicans to decide, Salatin writes, whether they're a party of national security or just a party of grievance and animosity. That question has now been answered.
Yeah, the Republicans are no longer the party of national security. And that was part of the reason, you know, I mean, I joined the Republican Party during the Cold War. And that was a big part of why I was a Republican, that I felt like the Republicans had a better handle on the threat from the Soviet Union. But, you know, this is where Republicans, of course, Charlie, you know, as we are often accused, we never think about what being Republicans was like, and we never think back and never reckon with the past. But, you know, the Republicans, I think one thing that deformed the Republican Party is that we were too much of a Cold War party, and we were too much centered on having an identifiable enemy in the Soviet Union. You know, you talked about Chinese and Russian, Chinese and Spanish and Arabic, and that's why I added, and Russian, because there was a time I learned Russian not only because I was entranced by the culture and, you know, because I share a religion with the Russian people, but it was the language of the enemy. And I felt like I had to understand, you know, the language that the enemy government spoke. And I think when the Cold War ended, the Republicans didn't know how to function without an identifiable, personalizable enemy. And I think that was a flaw in too many years of the Republicans carrying the lance rightly, and as they should have, carrying the lance of the Cold War, but not knowing how to make a transition to a world where then we really can step back and say, now we're going to be that shining city on a hill. Now that we are, now we're going to be just a good example to everyone in the world and not just the, you know, the fortress against communism. And so I think that, you know, Will's absolutely right about this, that we didn't know, the Republicans that have, you know, whatever they've morphed into now, didn't know how to deal with something that was an amorphous, non-personalizable enemy that required us simply to say, you know, we have to link arms, we have to, you know, engage in some shared sacrifice, we have to inconvenience ourselves. You know, the closest thing to it that I can think of where tempers flared, and you're old enough to remember this, was the gas crisis.
Yeah.
But even there, you could say it's the Arabs, right? It's the Arabs who did this to us. But you know, this is a good point
because there has been that sort of endless, restless search for who is going to be the new enemy. And as long as you can put a face on it, because they were willing to do all sorts of draconian things if the enemy was the caravans or Mexican rapists or Islamic terrorists or the Chinese. They need to put a face on it, and there seems to be kind of a through line in the faces that they're looking for.
Well, they've decided on a new enemy. The Republican Party has found its new enemy, and that new enemy is tens of millions of their fellow Americans.
All right, let's talk about Chris Christie. Chris Christie, who I have to admit, I go way back as a Christie observer. I remember when he used to come here to Wisconsin, and I made it a point to show up at a lot of the events while I was, you know, master of ceremonies at many of them back in the day. And I originally thought of him as one of the most gifted political speakers, political animals I have ever seen. So I was always fascinated by him. But then again, incredibly like disillusioned when he decided that he was going to be one of the first sock puppets for Donald Trump. When he endorsed Donald Trump, that was one of the key moments in normalizing Trump's candidacy, and that image of him standing, you know, behind, looking sort of, you know, blankly, is kind of indelibly.
When his soul left his body?
Yeah, exactly. Well, apparently he's trying to get his soul back in his body because, you know, having waffled all over the place, he gave a speech last night at the Reagan Library. And this has been widely billed as his sort of coming out, moving past Trump, possibly testing the waters for 2024. Let me just play this because he very specifically calls out the conspiracy theories and the election deniers. I mean, this is going to be, I think, pretty safe to say, an unforgivable sin in MAGA world. This was Chris Christie last night.
Listen, as Republicans, we need to free ourselves from the quicksand of endless grievances.
Oh.
We need to turn our attention to the future and stop wallowing in the past. Mm. We need to face the realities of the 2020 election and learn, not hide from them. We need to discredit the extremists in our midst the way we've done it before. And we'll discuss that a little bit more in a moment.
Names, please.
We need to renounce the conspiracy theorists and the truth deniers, the ones who know better, and the ones who are just plain nuts.
Okay. So, Tom Nichols, he's going to have to name names at some point, don't you think?
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, Chris Christie's role in elevating Donald Trump is unforgivable. And if this is how he's going to atone, well, that's great. I think it's very hard to trust him after all this. But if he's, I mean, he is. Let's give, you know, not three cheers, but one cheer for Chris Christie. He's doing this at considerable political and maybe even personal risk. To go out there and say this. But on the other hand, until he starts naming names and getting into, because, you know, Christie made his bones on, I'm the scrappy, tough guy that's going to get in your face. I'm the son of a bitch. Well, okay, Chris, time to wade in there, and start, you know, fingers and chests with some of your fellow Republicans and name names. And when you talk about conspiracy theorists and nuts and extremists, and I liked, you know, let's not let this slide. He said, the people who know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I have been talking about for a year now.
I see, but this is going to be wrenching, because I was thinking about the fact, you know, that you know, come 2024, there are going to be some very, very difficult moments, and there will be, again, very unexpected alliances. You know, I would never have expected that Mike Pence would have, stood up the way that he did in 2021. Doesn't mean that I'm a Pence fan or I'm going to forget what he did, but you need those allies. Christie is a tough sell, I have to say. There's no way I'm getting over this. On the other hand, what he said is necessary. It is crucial, right, to come from people like him, that we have got to step away from the crazy. And what he's doing is he's saying, look, if we're going to win elections, we have to have ideas. We have to have things. We can't wallow in our own grievances. The problem is that I don't see it any way right now that he's going to get any traction for all of this, because he's calling out Donald Trump in really pretty direct way, with the exception of the fact not naming him. But how do you break away from the crazy and the conspiracy theories without confronting directly the center of it all, which is Donald Trump himself?
Yeah, two things about what Christie said. One is, I'm not sure he's right when he says, well, you know, we can't get elected without, you know, the lesson of 2020. You know, we have to have ideas. We can't get, I'm sorry, but there are a whole bunch of Republicans that are getting elected without ideas, who are winning on, you know, pure lunacy and pure, you know, 150 proof rage that makes no sense. I mean, it's not even the justifiable rage of some, you know, policy. It's just, hey, you know, everybody hates you and you hate everybody and vote for me. And that's, you know, in Ohio, going back to Ohio, that might work. But the second thing about Christie, and again, this goes back to the one cheer for Chris thing, this message, that call has to come from within the house.
It's got to come in the house, right? Yeah.
It's got to come from somebody who was behind Trump, who knows Donald, as Chris calls him, as Chris Christie calls him, who knows Donald, who was inside the machinery. It's got to be somebody who steps forward and says, listen, I was one of you. I was inside the machine, and I'm telling you that you're being played, that this is bad. Because, you know, you and I and reform mind, you know, Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney and the rest of us can scream about it all day long, and it's... You know, it doesn't matter.
But that's the thing, is we used to be inside the house. And the moment we said it, we were outside the house. So the moment that Chris Christie says this, he's outside the house forever, right? I mean,
we were outside early. I mean, we were early leavers in that. I mean, you know, we weren't ever part of the, you
but
know,
Liz,
you,
Liz Cheney was a late adopter. Right.
Yeah. I mean, but she was never a Trumper either. I mean, she was a kind of a reluctant, yes, I'm a Republican, sort of rolling her eyes. I mean, this is a guy who destroyed Marco Rubio, which now looking back, I think is, you know, well deserved, but destroyed Rubio and cleared a path for Donald Trump instead of turning that acid, opposition to Trump. I mean, imagine how different, and I'm just going to, you know, we can't live in the past and we can't keep what-ifing the primaries. But imagine if both Rubio and Christie and others had just stopped the debate at some point, turned and looked at Donald and said, listen, I don't want any of these other guys to win because I think I should be president. But what the hell is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Well, see, all of us agree that you are, you know, if Senator Rubio gets ahead of me, I'm going to fight him and I'm going to try and get this nomination. But we all agree you are appalling. They wouldn't do it.
But if he had done it, who knows what would have happened? But you're right. The more I think about this, look, all of my instincts are to go, you know, screw Christie, just screw him. You know what he's done. On the other hand, this stuff has to come from inside the house, and to a certain extent, you think of, if you're Donald Trump, Chris Christie is the only guy who really, if he goes back to the old Chris Christie, who would, you know, face you down, who would say that. Because one of the things we learned was that everybody else was a complete wimp. You know, I mean, you know, what a wimp. You know, whether you're talking about Ted Cruz or Lindsey Graham, or you think of that stage. We remember back in 2016, we thought, boy, the Republicans have this really, really strong, you know, bench here. Look at all these people. You have Marco Rubio, you have Ted Cruz, you have Lindsey Graham, you have, you know, the governor of the state of Ohio, the governor of the state of Wisconsin. They all turned out with, well, I'll leave Kasich out of it because he's, well, but they all turned out to be wimps. They all turned out to be not being willing to put, to face down the bully. The thing is that Chris Christie is himself a bully. And so maybe that's what it takes to go, if he's willing to do it, as opposed to doing what Nikki Haley has done, all these other people who sort of put their toe in independence and then come scurrying back, you know, to kiss the orange, you know, the orange God King's ass. But if Chris Christie goes full Chris Christie, that's a challenge within the party that Donald Trump literally has not faced up until now.
And I think there's a couple of things that are interesting about Christie. First of all, the other thing is Christie knows him. They've lived in proximity to it. Christie has a lot of receipts on Trump in a way that other people don't. Christie knows a lot about Trump, and Christie deciding that he's in don't give a fuck mode and if he is, because let's face it, Christie has nothing to lose. He's not going to lose a Senate seat. He's not going to get primaried out of his House seat. He's not, you know, running for governor. So for Christie to go kamikaze here, you know, that could be a real threat to, as you say, somebody who finally goes toe-to-toe with Donald Trump. But the other thing about Christie, and I hope this is part of what's going on. If Chris Christie really is saying, look, win or lose going into this, you know, Republican electoral season, the best service I can do for my country and for the party that I once belonged to that I care about is to finally go head to head with all of these lunatics and really kind of out them in only the way that a loud, brash bully can do, then I say good for him. Then it's got to, you know, we both keep saying, it's got to happen from within. It can't be some, you know, reform-minded young Republican, you know, running in a primary in Ohio or Indiana somewhere. It's got to come from somebody who knows how to throw that punch in with somebody like Donald Trump. Because, you know, Donald Trump is a coward. Let's face it.
Right.
You know, all these other people wimped out. And the thing that really killed me about how fast everybody collapsed in 2016 is that nobody really tried to lay one on Trump, to really tag Trump in public, because he would have folded. Imagine if the Republicans, I'll just do one more imagine, Charlie. Imagine if the Republicans had said, you're not a Republican. We double dog dare you to run as a third party candidate. Go ahead. Give it your shot.
Reince Priebus was never going to do that. Okay, so my attitude, and I'm working through this in real time, is basically if I was in the room with Chris Christie, the conversation would go something like, Governor Christie, fuck you. Fuck you and everything you did. But having said that, have a seat. I'm listening, and I'm going to watch, okay? I'd have to vent. I'd have to blow off the steam. Like, you ask, what the fuck did you think was going to happen? What were you doing standing there? You know, I mean, are you embarrassed by that? Or, you know, we'd have to have that sort of like little cathartic moment. But then I go, okay, I'm listening. Give it your best shot. If you don't fold, because to a certain extent, look, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, they voted for Donald Trump to be reelected to get another term. And yet, you got to take the deep breath and go, all right, you don't get to always choose the army you go to war with, right, Professor?
And after, right, you, don't you put that Rumsfeld voodoo on me, buddy. You know, after the F-bomb catharsis to say, okay, and I have one more question for you, Governor. If it looks like this message, you know, is going to be rejected, are you going to fold again?
Yeah, that's it. That's what I'm saying. I am listening and watching. Right.
Yeah. If you're losing and the Republican faithful are saying, boo, Chris Christie, are you going to go Liz Cheney or are you going to go Nikki Haley?
Yes, that's exactly right. Are you going to go Liz Cheney or Nikki Haley? That's great.
And that's all I want to know.
I may steal that for a tweet.
You are, it is, we are friends and you are welcome to it. But, you know, that's really the decision. And yeah, you know, yes, thank you for inviting me to this meeting. Fuck you very much. And now, you know, I want to know, I don't have any other questions for you, because you're not going to, you know, you're not going to save the Republican Party single-handedly on this. But when the blowback comes, are you going to go Liz Cheney or are you going to go Nikki Haley? And that's my only question.
Because the third choice is you go back to that fucking beach where you're sitting there. On the lawn.
Right, you say,
chair.
Okay. You know, I said, well, okay, I tried. I spoke, you know, I gave one speech at the Reagan Library and everybody's mean to me, so I'm going back to the beach. No, not good enough. You owe the country more than that. You owe what's left. If there's a decent Republican, if there are 10 decent Republicans left, you owe it to them to go back and undo a lot of what you did. And it will be hard. You will get blowback and threats and vitriol and calumny and are you willing to, you know, are you as tough as you say you are, Governor? That, I guess that's the question, because nobody who went on that stage in 2016 turned out to be as tough as they were trying to advertise themselves to be.
Yeah. And none of them had what it took to either beat Donald Trump or to be president of the United States. So Tom Nichols, on that note of defiance, thanks for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday. We'll do this all over again.